176A. And if he's going to do this.
Right here? Right here?
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move we reconsider the vote by which the bill, by which we would reconsider Senate Bill 176, A. I ask we have unanimous consent to suspend the rules.
Representative Backen has moved the unanimous consent to suspend the rules. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Representative Backen?
Madam Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 176A was reconsidered. And we recommend that we send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Backen has asked that move that we should reconsider the vote by which we pass Senate Bill 176A to the floor. Is there any opposition to that motion? Hearing none. Bill, the motion carried and the vote has been reconsidered. You'll have to excuse us. We have the script and somebody got the script wrong.
Yes, Madam Chair, are we going to be making changes to the bill?
Yes.
At some point?
Yes, yes. Okay, there are no objections to the motion, so the bill is now before us.
Yeah, Madam Chairman. We are in work session at this time.
Yes.
I would move the dash A two amendments to Senate Bill 176. And as I understand it, these amendments simply reduce the penalty for the reduce the penalty for the abandoned vote issue that was before us in 176. Counsel, can you elaborate on that for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, previously, the Senate Bill 176 described the offense of leaving, abandoning the vote as a Class A misdemeanor. As you're aware, on the floor, there was some concern about this. Members thought it wise to bring it back. The bill before, it was before you, and the amendment before you, which reduced the Class A misdemeanor down to a Class B misdemeanor. Mr. Chairman.
She's got the gavel.
Yes, that's right. We have a motion before us, right, to consider.
To adopt the dash A two amendments.
To adopt the A two amendments. Are there any objections?
I have a question.
Yes.
Is that postponed or bill if you're not there?
Yes, Representative.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Were these amendments agreed to by the Marine Board?
I can't answer that. Does anybody?
Madam Chairwoman, I understand the word, but I do see that the representative of the Marine Board is here in the room.
Good, because I have another question beyond this one.
Don Heffer from the Marine Board.
Yes, can you tell us about the Marine Board?
Yes.
Have you seen the amendments?
Yes, I have. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Paul Don Heffer, Director of the Board. We have seen and concur with the amendment, the A two amendments to the bill.
Okay, and then I.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have, not related to the amendment, but related to the original bill. May I ask it now?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Sir, when I was preparing my floor presentation for this bill, something occurred to me that I didn't know the answer to. It was on page two of the bill. It says, "Unless the boat presents a hazard, the law enforcement agency shall allow a sufficient time before taking the boat into custody to allow a hearing under Section 9 of this 1999 Act." It doesn't specify what the sufficient period of time is. Is that to be determined by the law enforcement agency in the community, or? what?
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, that would, that's sufficient time, is time for the hearing, and if you refer to Section 9, Subsection 1, that it shall not, it indicates in line 27, shall not be removed unless it constitutes a hazard. So unless it's a hazard, there's a minimum of 5 days period of time there, and since that does not include holidays, Saturdays, or Sundays, potentially 7 or 8 days at the minimum before an agency would move to take custody of the vote. So it's to allow sufficient time for that hearing. They have 5 days to request the hearing.
Okay.
So the only time it would be removed with any haste is if it does constitute an immediate hazard or threat to the public, as provided in Section 5. And in most cases, the logistics of removing it are going to mean that it's going to sit there a little longer than even 5 days at a minimum. But that's the minimum.
Right. Okay, great. Well, that was not clear to me when I was working on the bill, but fortunately, no one asked that question.
Madam Chair, if I may.
It's actually Mr. Chair now. She gave me the gavel. So, Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Representative Chair. My sense on the floor of why this failed so utterly was out of a concern for the strong penalties that are in this bill at page 4, line 44, a violation is a Class A misdemeanor, and at page 5, line 2, another violation would be a Class C felony. An A misdemeanor carries a year in prison and substantial economic fine. A Class C felony is 5 years in prison and a substantial fine. And this seems to be very punitive in light of just leaving a boat laying around for 48 hours or a week or whatever. So are we going to address that? Are there any amendments that address that? All right,
Council,
in line 45, please explain to me how the A2s address that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, as members are aware, originally the penalty which was envisioned in the bill was a Class A misdemeanor, which is up to a year in prison or a $5,000 fine. By adopting the motion before you on the A2s would change to a Class B misdemeanor, which would adopt a penalty of up to 6 months in jail or a $2,000 fine.
Mr. Chairman, if I could clarify.
Yes, Mr. Hepner, feel free to.
That the reference in line 2 there to Class C felony is to a different statute. There is no felony provision associated with this.
Thank you for clarifying that. Representative Wells, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm trying to read the bill also. 830.383 then is what this bill is addressing, and that's the reason it's the Class B.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wells, the operative language is on page 4 of the bill. If you look at the original bill, where the highlighted portion refers to Section 3 of the bill, and you go back up to Section 3, what's been changed is that same line, which has been moved to the Class B misdemeanor. So the offense described in Section 3 of the bill would then become the Class B.
I guess my question is, how is that moved to Class B?
Right there in the amendment, the A2s delete the language from the original bill, which would talk about
that. See, yeah, Mr. Chair, I see that. It deletes it, but
and then it replaces it.
Oh, we're putting in 830.383 on line 4, page 43. There we go.
That's right.
Insert and Section 3. We're going to have a problem following this amendment, aren't we, here on this end of the table? There we go.
Seems to happen when we reconsider. Are we all tracking now, colleagues?
So we're moving on, Mr. Chair, we're moving on Section 3 of this 1999 Act up to line 43 then.
That's
took it out of the other and moved it up there.
That's correct.
No, I'm with you. All I need to do is read the amendment.
Okay, good. No, that's I understand. We're moving fast and furious here. So, colleagues, we have the Dash A2 amendments before us. Are there any objections? Any further discussion? Hearing none, the A2s are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I move Senate Bill 176 as amended by the dash two to the House with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 176 as amended with the dash A2 amendments to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Representative Witt. Why don't we call the roll, Nancy?
Representative Backman.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Lowe.
Aye.
Representative Verbalow.
I'm not sure this does what we think it does, and so I am going to vote no at this point.
Aye.
Yes.
Representative Williams.
Votes aye.
Representative Witt.
No.
Excused. Senate Bill 176 is amended, receiving the majority. It's declared passed. It will go to the floor, and Representative Walker will give you an opportunity
to redeem yourself
and assign you to carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Unfortunately, the chairman of the committee is still detained in the Ways and Means Committee. We will go ahead and open a public hearing on HGR 29. Without him being here, and I don't see Representative Mannix. Is he still here? Is he in the hall?
Yeah.
I'll send counsel to poll. Representative Mannix will begin our testimony, and I see Representative Rasmussen will give her a chance as well. I'll just make this announcement to those of you who are attending. When this hearing was initially scheduled, we were not aware that we would be having an afternoon floor session. So the House is meeting in floor session today, and the committee members have been excused to be present for this hearing in an effort to hopefully not upset too many of your schedules. That will cause, you'll see us probably scurrying in and out as various votes come to the floor, and if we are subject to a call of the House, we may be required to actually go and attend the floor session. Some of us are carrying bills today on the floor and may be needed on the floor for purposes of carrying those bills. In an effort, therefore, to accommodate the members as best as possible, I'd ask Representative Mannix to come forward and begin his testimony. So I will now open a public hearing on HGR 29.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem, and I am pleased to have the opportunity to make a brief presentation to you in regard to HGR 29. I would ask you to consider the Dash 6 amendments as the latest iteration of HGR 29. Over time during the session, we've had an opportunity to engage in some discussions about the appropriate format and language for HGR 29, and the Dash 6 is the last formal version. At the same time, I would mention to you that I will soon request a Dash 7 because as part of this continuing process of refinement, it's become obvious that the Dash 6 is not quite up to snuff either. And I'll read to you how the Dash 6 amendments would be changed into what would be proposed as the Dash 7. The change would be that the sentences would be switched so that we would start off at what is line 7 of the Dash 6 to read, for purposes of this Constitution and all laws, ordinances, and regulations, and to be valid or recognized in this state, a marriage change made to shall consist only of the union of one man and one woman. The second sentence would be modified to read, no provision of this Constitution requires the granting of the rights or benefits of marriage to unmarried individuals. Now, people ask, why put the definition of marriage in the Constitution? That's the first question. Isn't the statutory definition, which is pretty close to this, satisfactory? The answer is that a statutory definition, the creation of a relationship by statute, does not quite elevate that relationship to the level that may be necessary to protect it from assault through the judicial interpretation process. This became evident in the Tanner decision, which I'll discuss in a moment. But basically, it is necessary, in the opinion of many of us, to put the definition of marriage into the Constitution so that there is no argument that somehow this is a second-class status that doesn't deserve the highest possible consideration by the judiciary when they are interpreting various relationships. The second question is, why do we need to say anything further about the granting of the rights or benefits of marriage to unmarried individuals. And the reason is because of the judicial activism engaged in by the Court of Appeals, which will have substantial ripple effect throughout this society over the next few years. Let me point out first that there is nothing in the Dash 6 amendments or in the to be proposed, I would think, Dash 7, that depends on the next number to be assigned, amendments, which deals with issues that have been raised by others as to homosexuality. All that the Dash 6 amendments do is affirm a relationship that is culturally recognized, socially recognized, has been traditionally recognized in law, has been recognized in religious tradition for thousands of years, and that is a relationship between a man and a woman coming together for purposes of becoming married and, in many cases, having children and certainly remaining together, one would hope forever, but certainly in most instances for many years. The provisions here do not, I repeat, do not protect, excuse me, prevent any unit of government from enacting as a matter of policy benefits or privileges that might be extended to other individuals or groups. In other words, for instance, the Fortland Ordinance, which presently is on the books, which provides for a certain amount of domestic partner benefits, is perfectly valid under this revised version of H.J.R. 29. On the other hand, that ordinance is not required, nor is any other unit of government required to implement such an ordinance. I emphasize this because what we are doing is taking a position of neutrality as to whether or not any unit of government ought to do anything special about domestic partner benefits, but we are drawing a firm line in protection of the traditional family unit, marriage, or the essential element of the family unit, as to the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and any other interpretation of the Constitution which might denigrate the status of marriage. This gets us to the Tanner decision. The essence of the Court of Appeals decision in Tanner, which came down in December, was this. Tanner said that homosexual relationships or homosexuality involved a suspect classification, and the court would then look at any such relationships in comparison to the statutory scheme and require the government to show the highest possible level of need to allow any kind of discrimination against that suspect classification. The court went on to say in that particular case that government units would have to provide essentially domestic partner benefits to homosexual couples living together who had affirmed a relationship or made a commitment to one another because government was already providing such benefits to married heterosexual couples. Ironically, the court went on to say that unmarried heterosexual couples do not have the benefit of access to benefits under that decision because they could get married. In other words, in affirming the opportunity and capability of state government or any unit of government to recognize and validate traditional marriage, the court turned right around and said, however, if you do that in the granting of any rights or benefits, this is how I read the decision, you're going to have to provide the same rights or benefits to homosexual couples, but you don't have to provide them to heterosexual couples. I consider it perverse reasoning. I consider the decision to be revolutionary. There is no other state that's had this kind of decision imposed on it through the judicial process. Hawaii came close, and then through a constitutional process, Hawaii changed course. Oregon now is coming close to a series of situations where we are going to see society turned upside down in terms of the marriage relationship, based on a reinterpretation of the Oregon Constitution by the Court of Appeals. Without a change of a phrase, without a change of a word, the Oregon Court of Appeals read new meaning into the Equal Protection Clause of the Oregon Constitution, contrary to decisions of a number of other states who have said states may grant special status and benefits and privileges to marriage between a man and a woman. H.J.R. 29 simply refers to the voters the opportunity to make the statement that we do reaffirm the traditional definition of marriage, we reaffirm the power and authority of government to give married couples the rights or benefits of marriage as opposed to anyone else. At the same time, we go no further. We may be tolerant of other kinds of relationships, and even as a matter of policy, the legislature or any unit of government may do what it wants to grant benefits to any other kind of relationship. But in granting benefits to marriage, The government is not obligated through equal protection arguments to grant those same benefits to some other, I'll call it, family unit. That's what the balance is all about here in HDR 29. It's a positive statement and an affirmation and a protective clause as to marriage. Nothing more, but nothing less. And I'd encourage your positive consideration of the measure.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, are you familiar with a letter from Mr. Chamoff, Legislative Counsel, to all members back in December following the Tanner decision, wherein he cautioned that the language of the court, I quote from his letter, he said, the court said that it could envision no justification for distinguishing between people based on their homosexuality, end of quote. Do you believe that Mr. Chamoff, in essence, is pointing out that the marriage statute very well could be overturned by the court through the logic of Tanner?
Yes, and in essence, Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, the essential meaning of the marriage statute will be overturned over time. It will slowly be pushed over. It will take rounds and rounds of litigation over the next few years. We've seen the first ripple in the pond with an opinion that is coming out, or has come out, excuse me, from Assistant Attorney General Schuman, or Deputy Attorney General Schuman, in regard to the tax code. That's just the first ripple. I could begin at birth and take you all the way to death, and I'll jump from the beginning to the end and mention that every single statute of the hundreds that relates to or implies relationship to the traditional marriage relationship is going to be affected. Where do I start with? Family medical leave? No, I'll go back to parental leave for childbirth. We'll be able to hear litigation, I'm sure, in the future that's going to say, wait a minute, a mom and dad who are married have a child, and either parent may take leave to care for the child. Now, it's okay if the parents are unmarried and the mom is with the child, and we're not talking about a biological father, let's set that aside, well, then we can probably say it's that father doesn't get to have parental leave. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But if it's a homosexual couple, a lesbian couple, and the woman has a child, under equal protection, the other member of that relationship will be able to demand parental leave because she should stand in the same relationship as a biological parent or a married parent of the child. Then I'll take you all the way to death, the other end of the life spectrum, intestate succession. We have statutes right now that grant preferred status to married couples in terms of how we handle the estate if there is not a will. Those statutes are going to be under attack because why shouldn't a homosexual couple living together, committed to each other, have the same benefits of intestate succession, meaning what you do with the estate when there's no will? Of course, a heterosexual couple living together will not have that same argument, according to the Court of Appeals on Tanner, because they could have gotten married. I'm just picking two examples at either end of the life spectrum to show you the kinds of ramifications. The tax code is one ripple. There will be many. This is an opportunity for the legislature to intervene in a positive way, not to oppress anyone, but to affirm where we have been and where we are in terms of the marriage relationship.
Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a couple of comments before my question. I think if we want to know what Mr. Chamoff was meaning, we should go to the source and not in the law that's called hearsay, what representative just did in trying to tell you what Mr. Chamoff meant. The other comment I wanted to make, today I've heard twice the word perverse decision by the Supreme Court. I wanted to be very clear that what a perverse decision is when it goes against you, and is always a loser and a winner in a Supreme Court case. That doesn't necessarily make it perverse. It just means the Supreme Court did not agree with your reasoning, which has happened to all of us. My question is, I actually have two questions. One is, why would the state, and that's us, the legislature, want to put in the Constitution a religious-based definition of marriage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Werbelow, I don't think the state would want to put into the Constitution a definition of marriage that is based solely on religion. However, if you infuse it with social development and culture, as well as religious development and what I'll call religious diversity, I think you can arrive at a point where you call it a moral determination by society as to its standards. For instance, in our standards right now, we prohibit polygamy. which in some religious societies is a definition of marriage, but we have chosen as a society not to allow that broad a definition to apply. In fact, there were cases involving polygamy that went through the courts, and the courts reaffirmed the power of the state to say, no, you shouldn't go beyond that.
Second question.
Sure.
Okay. When you were responding to a question, you were saying what could happen down the line with children and so forth and so on, a kind of a list of whores that, according to you. However, you know, the only reason those whores exist, as you call them, not me, is because we do not allow committed people in certain circumstances to enter into a marriage type of relationship. So it's not something they are choosing. So I guess what I'm saying, why are they whores? I mean, if we allowed them to, if we honored their commitment, as we do, what is traditionally a married couple now, we would not see them as whores. So I guess what I want to know, why do you think they're whores now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Werbelow, the point about validation versus tolerance is important here. As far as I'm concerned, we as a society have a right to validate a certain kind of relationship that we establish as traditional marriage. We certainly have an obligation to be tolerant of a wide variety of viewpoints and lifestyles, but we don't have an obligation to put the government stamp of approval on those relationships. We certainly may, as a matter of social policy, decide to do that, and I would invite proponents of single-sex marriage or any other kind of special relationship, including polygamy if they wish, to go to the ballot box and get the voters to support it or to convince the Legislative Assembly to change the statutes to recognize it. And there's nothing in this HJR 29 as proposed which would prevent that from happening. What I do object to is persons using the courts to rewrite social structures when that's really the purview of the legislature and the people, not the judiciary.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. First of all, I take huge offense at the characterization of a court doing its job interpreting our laws as judicial assault or judicial activism. They are a co-equal branch of this government, and they are worthy of respect. They should get it from another co-equal branch of the government. Their job, we make the laws, they interpret them. That's their job, and I applaud them for doing so. I think that it's unworthy of us to attack them verbally. And secondly, if you do think that the Tanner decision is flawed in that it discriminates unfairly against heterosexual unmarried couples, why aren't we considering passing something that would allow an extension of benefits to unmarried heterosexual couples who are in a stable relationship?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, you're certainly in the position to offer either a majority report, a minority report, or an alternative resolution which would do that. I personally think that would be a stupid policy choice and totally contrary to what the voters of the state would ever vote for, and in my opinion would be wrong. And so, we, as a legislature, can make whatever choices we want about what we send out to the voters. But the choice that's in front of you is a choice that a number of us think that a majority of the legislators in the House and the Senate would approve, and the vast majority of the voters will approve. And by the way, I think that it's appropriate for this branch of government to characterize an opinion as opposed to the judges. I've seen a lot of opinions that are wonderfully written and are very good, and I've seen a lot of opinions that are poorly written and are bad, and I've seen a few that are judicial adventurism, in my view, and perverse, in my view. I think Tanner qualifies in the first rank of the judicial adventurism category. I think the judges went way out of line compared to every other court in the United States except the Supreme Court of Hawaii, but we're all entitled to our opinion of that. Certainly the judges get to issue their opinions with review by other judges. It's up to the legislature to decide whether or not we want to take the issue to the voters and let the ultimate reviewers, the voters, make a decision. I'm proposing right here, as are others, that the voters be given the opportunity to make this decision. And again, alternative proposals can be presented, and if the legislature wants to vote for them too, that's fine.
Okay. Anything further for Representative Mannix? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I see Representative Rasmussen. Are there any other members? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Anita Rasmussen. I'm a state representative out of Southwest Portland. Fundamentally, there are 210 rights for the crew to a couple when they are allowed to marry. There are rights that immediately show up at that point, at that ceremony. And I've spent a fair amount of my life and times listening to gay and lesbian couples who, at this point in time, the law stands between them and a state-sanctified marriage. And I have listened to them talk about some of the pain and some of the frustration, some of the very key places of the heart that the law stands between. And if we're going to list out some of those places of pain, I would certainly share with them at the point of a hospitalization, emergency hospitalization, and decision-making over your partner, as when the partner, she or he herself, cannot be cared for. And as I've listened to these gay and lesbian couples, and I've watched their relationships, and I have listened to their stories, I find no compelling reason to stand between them and a state-sanctified marriage. I find that there is certainly no need to defend my marriage from these relationships. And I found that I've listened to these partners, that partnerships, that in actuality, my marriage becomes strengthened by what is lived out in front of me and shared with me in these relationships. And for them, and for my constituents, and for myself, I ask that you turn away from this resolution and we allow this state to move forward. Certainly, I would strongly resist putting anything into the Constitution at this point in time on these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for the representative? All right. Thanks very much for coming up today. Next, just to give you an overview where we're going here, I want to call Dave Schumann forward to give us, now that we have heard the members' testimony, we'll get back to sort of the outline of the hearing, which would be an overview from David Schumann. We also have Greg Chamov here with us. If there are questions about Legislative Council's interpretation of either the Tanner opinion or the resolution or the Attorney General's opinion from yesterday, or issued today, I guess. Then when we finish that overview for our committee background, we have invited testimony that I will be calling forward in alternating panels of pro and con. For those of you who are in the room that have not signed up to testify, this is an invited testimony only session. We will not be taking action on the resolution today, and so I would invite submission of any written testimony that you may want to bring forward between now and Friday. We'll hold the record open that long. So, with that said, and one other thing, we may be interrupted from time to time today with a call of the House. The House is in session, and we are excused, the members of this committee are excused from the business of the House, but if there is a call of the House, we'll be required to recess the hearing and report to the floor for a vote. And if that happens, we'll do that, and then we will reconvene as soon as the vote is taken. So, with that said, Mr. Schumann, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Schumann. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Chair Federally asked me to come to this hearing this afternoon with a limited mandate. My task is to explain, as best I can, the Court of Appeals decision in Tanner versus Oregon Health Sciences University, and also the Attorney General opinion that Representative Mannix referred to earlier. Oregon Health Sciences University had a policy in which it gave to its employees the option of purchasing insurance for their spouses and dependents through the employer's group benefits plan. Oregon Health Sciences University did not give that option to their employees with respect to domestic partners. In 1995, three lesbian employees of OHSU and their domestic partners sued Oregon Health Sciences University, the state of Oregon, the state system of higher education, the executive department, seeking a judicial declaration that OHSU's policy violated the Fair Employment Statutes, ORS Chapter 659, and also Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution, which provides that the state must make privileges available to different classes of people on the same terms equally. The plaintiffs also sought an injunction compelling Oregon Health Sciences University to begin providing these benefits on an equal basis to their employees with spouses and to their employees with same-sex domestic partners. Plaintiffs prevailed in a trial in Multnomah County. The state appealed. At that point, OHSU, pursuant to a legislative decision, was made a semi-private agency, not part of state government. At around the same time, and this is not directly relevant to the outcome of the case, OHSU voluntarily decided to begin extending benefits to all of its employees. The state appealed the trial court decision that went to the Court of Appeals, and in a unanimous three-judge panel opinion in December of 1998, the court ruled affirming the trial court's opinion, or most of the trial court's opinion. Court of Appeals dealt with both the statutory challenge to OHSU's policy and the constitutional challenge. The court held that under the fair, the court said that under the Fair Employment Statute, all employers in this state are prohibited from having policies that have the effect, whether intended or not, of discriminating against employees with same-sex domestic partners, with one exception. That exception was in relation to discrimination in a bona fide employee benefits plan. Therefore, according to the Court of Appeals, Oregon Health Sciences University did not violate Chapter 659 because the alleged discrimination took place with respect to a bona fide employee insurance plan. So the court moved on to the constitutional question, the question under Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. And the court began by articulating a rule, and then it followed through by applying that rule to the situation in the Tanner case. The rule is as follows. When a government action, be it a statute, a rule, a policy, or a practice, has the effect, intended or unintended, of denying anything of value to a class of citizens who, and now I am quoting the court, have been the subject of adverse social or political stereotyping or prejudice, end quote, then in those situations, the statute, the rule, the practice, the policy, whatever it is from government, can be justified only by genuine, relevant differences between the classes. Okay. I will restate that rule because it's fairly complicated. When a government action, usually a statute or a regulation, has the effect, intended or unintended, of denying a benefit to a class of citizens who have traditionally been the subject of adverse social or political stereotyping, then the government has to justify that discrimination by citing genuine, relevant differences between the two classes, the class that gets the benefits and the class that doesn't get the benefits. Applying that rule to the situation before it, the court held that homosexuals, and I am quoting, in our society, are indeed subjected to adverse social and political stereotyping and prejudice. Therefore, there has to be a good governmental reason based on genuine differences between spouses and same-sex domestic partners, a genuine difference between those two classes that rationally accounts for giving one of them insurance coverage and not the other. It's not a blanket statement that discrimination based on sexual orientation is unconstitutional. It is a statement that when such discrimination occurs, it must be based on a genuine difference between the two classes that is relevant to the benefit that is being withheld or granted. And in this situation, there was no rational account for the government's policy of providing insurance coverage for spouses but not domestic partners. Therefore, the court concluded, Oregon Health Sciences University must make available benefits to the same-sex domestic partners of its employees to the same extent that it made the benefits available to the spouses. Now, that is the sum and substance of the Tanner opinion. I want to point out what it says and what it does not say. It does not say definitively that the Fair Employment Statute requires all employers not to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, although that is a strong implication of the opinion. It does not hold that the Oregon Constitution requires private employers, landlords, schools, churches, etc., not to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. It is a constitutional holding. The Constitution runs against the government only. It does not directly address the issue of the constitutionality of the marriage statute, and in fact, in footnote 3, it explicitly disavows saying anything about it. It does not hold that the state needs a genuine good reason to discriminate against opposite sex domestic partners. The state is more or less free to do that at will. And what is probably the most important feature of Tanner versus Oregon Health Sciences University is that it is not an opinion of the highest appellate court in the state of Oregon. It is an opinion of the Oregon Court of Appeals. The issue has not arisen before the Oregon Supreme Court. I will now briefly describe the formal opinion that we issued, that the Attorney General issued today. Incidentally, I should clarify for the record, the representative said that it was an opinion from me. In fact, it's an opinion signed by the Attorney General and indeed written by another Assistant Attorney General. I certainly read it and agree with its conclusions, as does the Attorney General, but it is by no stretch of the imagination my opinion. We were asked by a representative to rule on, to offer an opinion on the constitutionality of a revenue statute. The Oregon Department of Revenue treats the money that an employee receives from an employer and spends on insurance to cover a spouse or a dependent as non-taxable income. The money that an employee gets from an employer and spends to cover a spouse or dependent is not considered taxable income. On the other hand, money that an employee gets from an employer to spend on insurance coverage for a domestic partner is taxable income under the current Oregon Revenue Code. It's a complicated question. Question being, is that statute constitutional under Tanner? The answer was not nearly as complicated as the question. We think that the answer is such a situation does violate the Constitution as interpreted by Tanner. It is a relatively straightforward question focused on precisely the same issue that the Court of Appeals dealt with in Tanner, namely discrepancies between employee benefit plans that cover spouses and employee benefit plans that cover domestic partners. So we issued a 1.5-page opinion responding to the request from Representative Taylor.
Okay. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schuman, I was interested just in your last comment about the fact that moving back to the Tanner opinion and not to the to the AG's opinion for the moment, but your comment that because Tanner
issued from our Court of Appeals and not the Supreme Court, that it perhaps is not the last word on this subject, and I guess I'm interested in that. I mean, would you agree with me that right now Tanner is, in fact, the law of the land as it exists in the state of Oregon?
Representative Federley, and Representative Williams, yes, that is true. It is the final adjudication of that particular case. Yes.
And in fact, in the Attorney General's opinion that was issued just this morning officially, it was Tanner that was relied on in giving the advice that was requested by Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, that is true. And unless and until the Oregon Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court under a federal constitution articulates a different rule, state government is bound by the Court of Appeals decision in Tanner. Yes.
And the final question, and I know I'm going to put you in a spot, Mr. Schuman, and I'm not intending to do that, and I'd like you to explain to me why I'm wrong about this, but as I read Tanner, the question that was specifically not addressed in footnote 3 that you referenced seems to me to be yet an unresolved question, and one could potentially, under the Article 1, Section 20 analysis, not unlike the one that you gave in the opinion on May 25th, come to the conclusion that under Tanner, same-sex marriage would be required or could not be prohibited. And I guess I'd like your opinion on that issue. I know Tanner didn't address it, but if you back through the Article 1, Section 20 analysis that Tanner offers, I guess maybe I'll even let you take off your Deputy Attorney General hat and you can just talk to me, law professor to law student.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, on some other occasion I would be delighted to take off my Deputy Attorney General hat and have a candid conversation with you on that issue. I don't think that it's possible for me to take off that hat in this venue. I would also be extremely reluctant to speculate about the application of the rule in Tanner to any situation that has not come before the court or that our office has not had the chance to study and articulate an answer to. I think I can tell you with some degree of confidence what the rule that the court would apply is, presuming that it was the same panel of the same court, and it's the rule that I articulated. When government does something that denies a privilege to a group of people that has been historically subjected to prejudice, government has to have a genuine reason for doing so that is relevant to the benefit. Apply that rule to the benefit of a state-sanctioned marriage. That's what the court will do. How that will come out is something that I would really prefer not to try and predict. Among other reasons, because in one way or another, should a challenge to the marriage statute arise, our office would be in the position of defending the marriage statute, and I would be reluctant to go on the record with speculation and hypotheticals that could come up and bite me later.
Fair enough.
Yep, very fair. Thank you.
Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schuman, I'm interested in this footnote 3. The issue in front of the court in Tanner, of course, was not marriage. It was insurance benefits. So wouldn't it be expected that the court would make clear that their ruling was only on the issue that was in front of the court, which was specifically insurance benefits? And this footnote 3 affirmed that the decision here is simply on the question in front of the court. And thus they were saying, we're not even dealing with the issue here of the marriage statute because that's not the issue in front of us.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, that's exactly right. The court, I think we have no reason not to take the court exactly at its word. They are stating that this is not the issue before them and they are not announcing anything about it.
Yeah, we can follow up. Mr. Schuman, are you aware of any other court in any other state in the United States that has come down with a decision similar to the Tanner decision, in other words, requiring all government units in that state, irrespective of their particular policies or laws, to provide benefits to unmarried homosexual partners?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, there is no other such decision. Now, I should clarify that the Oregon court's decision is based on the Oregon Constitution. So no other state would be applying that legal argument. However, the issue has arisen in a number of other states under those states' constitution and under the federal constitution, and Oregon's case has a unique outcome.
Mr. Schuman, I got a question. You're not the court. The Department of Justice is the attorneys for the state. The Attorney General is the attorney for the state agencies and departments and commissions. I guess the question I have is, what is the effect of this opinion? I understand it's a response to an inquiry that comes from a legislator, but it addresses specific issues as to tax treatment of benefits. Does this constitute a directive to the Department of Revenue as well? What follows from this?
Chair Satterlee, this constitutes our legal advice to the department. It actually doesn't constitute legal advice to the Department of Revenue because it's an answer to a question raised by someone who was not involved in that department. The Department of Revenue, looking at this opinion, it seems to me faces choices. If they choose to follow the advice that is implicit in this opinion, they must treat, for purposes of state income tax, money that is used to buy insurance for domestic partners the same as they treat money that is used to buy insurance for spouses. Their choice is they can either treat both as taxable or both as non-taxable. This opinion does not direct them to do either. It simply says they must treat them both the same.
Is that the department's discretion, or is that a legislative directive? I understand that we have a constitutional overlay here, but can the department choose to do one or the other?
Chair Satterlee, the department is obligated to do what it believes the legislature would authorize or did authorize, and if the legislature explicitly addresses that issue during this session, then that answers the question, and there's no speculation.
Senator Quinn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schuman, one other question. Are you aware of the number of government units in the state of Oregon, city, county, special district, school district, so forth, that were providing the benefits that TANF requires as compared to those that were not, that now are required to under the TANF decision?
Chair Satterlee, Representative Witt, I'm not aware of that. I don't have the figures. I know Portland and Ashland were two, but that's all I know about.
Any other questions? For Mr. Schuman, Representative Edwards.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schuman, for being here today. I want to go back. You made a comment, and there was an issue discussed earlier about unmarried couples. Could you go back over the TANF decision you were saying I didn't touch on unmarried couples of opposite sex? Is that correct?
Chair Satterlee, Representative Edwards, that is correct. The TANF decision does not impose any obligation on government actors to treat different sex domestic partners the same as spouses.
I guess follow up on that. To follow along that line, you also were talking about sort of the test that the courts put out, that you can't justify an action of discrimination unless there's a rationale for it. Could you just kind of give us a little more of an example of what the court looked at? I haven't read the case, so I'm sort of ignorant on that. But just what are those types of tests that are out there?
Chair Satterlee, Representative Edwards, the court doesn't take off a list of suggested rationales and say none of these is rational. The court simply says, neither party to this litigation has suggested a reason for making this discrimination, and we can think of none. Now, the classic example under the federal constitution is by analogy race discrimination. Many people think that the federal constitution says it's unconstitutional to discriminate on the basis of race. Well, it doesn't say that. It says if you discriminate on the basis of race, there must be a reason that is based on the physical differences between one race and another race. So, for example, a statute requiring African Americans to be tested for sickle cell anemia discriminates on the basis of race, but it's a discrimination that's based on a genuine, relevant difference. What the court said in Tanner was they could think of no genuine relevant difference, and no one had suggested one.
Yes, and again, back to the Tanner case, was the couple that the case was based on, had they had a long-term relationship, or was the timing, the length of their relationship an issue here?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Edwards, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals specified that in order to qualify as a same-sex domestic partner and therefore receive treatment equal to a spouse, there were certain criteria involving mutual commitment, long-term relationships, for example, mingling of finances, intention to stay in a relationship, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Mr. Shetterly, well, I suppose it's a speculative question, but I'll ask it in light of the opinion that you've offered here that affects the Department of Revenue and the way that they handle tax collections and treat these issues for tax purposes. Do you anticipate requests for opinions from other state agencies regarding programs that they administer that are similarly driven in part by issues relating to marital status?
Chair Shetterly, I
don't have anything specific in mind, but
I expect we'll be getting some mail.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schumann. Appreciate you coming forward. All right. Let me we'll go to some panel testimony here. I invite first do this at three at a time, and I would encourage you to encourage witnesses to be as brief as possible. I understand this is something we certainly don't want to I don't want to shut anybody down. By the same token, I do want to finish this hearing this afternoon. With that said, I'd like to invite Dr. Earl Radmacher, is it, and Reverend Jerry Probst, and Mike Howden. If you all three would come forward, we'll let you proceed, perhaps in that order. And I think, too, if I would ask if you have written testimony rather than just read the testimony, if you could summarize for us what the testimony says, that will speed the testimony as well today, too.
Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak to you. I find it an educational exercise each time I come down here to see the process, and we appreciate what you do. I learn a great deal in the process of preparing my own notes, but also in listening to things that take place, both pro and con, on issues. And it is indeed a learning process. My name is Jerry Probst. I am a minister. I've served on the pastoral staff of Hillsborough First Baptist Church for 29 and a half years. And during that time, I've been involved in the solemnization of more marriages than I care to count. I also do premarital and marital counseling on a regular basis. And I have served for the last 14 years as a volunteer chaplain with the Hillsborough Police Department, police and fire departments. And on occasions, many occasions, I've been called to do intervention in domestic disturbance situations and other kinds of family needs. And I believe that these experiences have given me the opportunity to examine some of the dynamics of family relationships at their best and even at their worst. And I would like to speak in favor of this resolution. Some might think it's unnecessary to have such a bill, and I think we've heard some of that discussion already. I believe it's better to be proactive than reactive. If we see, in fact, that there is a need to address the issue, I classify it as building the wall before the assault begins. And I think that another thought that has come to my mind, even as we've been here, is the statement that I've already heard, and I want to reinforce it, and that is, I believe that the people of the state of Oregon have the right to express themselves on this issue, and would ask that you give them the opportunity to do so. The institution of marriage is based upon the principle of one man and one woman for life, and that institution has stood the test of time. I was just reading in most recent copy of Parade magazine about even in some of our public life, the long marriages of people like Carl Malden, who was married to his wife for 60 years. Harry Como and his wife were married for 65 before she passed away. DeForest Kelly, who is Star Trek's Dr. McCoy, has been married to his wife for 53 years. And I realized that in the Judeo-Christian heritage of which I am a part, that this system, this institution of one man, one woman for life, has worked well for over 4,000 years. We kind of operate around our house. If it ain't fixed, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Where it has failed, it's been the institution, not the institution that's failed, but it's been those who have abused the institution along the way. And most of those abuses have led to pain and suffering and worse, not just for the participants on an individual basis, but oftentimes for the society as a whole. I realize that this is religious response, but that's where I come from, and I cannot deny it. At one point in Jesus' own ministry, a discussion came up about marriage and divorce, and he said, what God has joined together, let not man take apart. And from that statement, I infer that Jesus was teaching that marriage is far more than a civil contract. It is, in fact, a sacred trust delivered to man by his Creator to be administered according to a standard which should supersede human opinion and preferences. And at another time, in talking with a woman who had been involved in many relationships, he asked her to go get her husband, and she said, I have no husband. And he said, you've spoken truly because you've had five husbands, and the man that you're now living with is not your husband. And the point that I would make out of that is that this interchange seems to indicate that Jesus did not legitimize just any living arrangement as constituting a marriage, and I believe that we should not either. Going further back in a document that goes back at least 3,000 years, it states, Moses writes, for this cause shall a young man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they too shall be one flesh. This is probably one of the earliest definitions of marriage to be found in our heritage, and it clearly sets the boundaries where HJR 29 would set them, and not just for religious reasons, but for some very practical ones, because marriage is about responsibility. It's not just simply about rights, and I think that in what we do in law is meant to establish not merely privilege or rights, but is to give a certain boundary to responsibilities so that they will be taken seriously. Marriage serves a purpose. It's not about having sex when you want it. You can do that now without a marriage license. It's not about living together. You can do that without a marriage license. It's not about passing on a property or the joint ownership of property. You can also do now that now without a license. And we've seen that. We sold a piece of property several years ago to a couple who are not married. Marriage does provide the basis for the establishment of a family, and it gives the freedom to be a family, to bring children into the world and give them the legacy that our lives and our faith would afford them. And there are additional laws which come out of that precept in some measure for the protection of the family because, again, as I say, marriage is more about responsibility than it is about rights. And regardless of what public opinion or supposed public opinion has been at times, it's still true that the best environment for a child is a home where there is a father and a mother who are mutually lovingly committed to one another for life. I have a sign that hangs over my office and a desk, and it says this: the best thing that I can do for my mother or for my children is to love their mother. And I don't see that our problem is that marriage is broken and it needs to be fixed. I see it is that we are not taking the responsibilities of marriage as serious as we ought. And we are the ones sometimes who need to be fixed, not the institution of marriage. And I believe that HJR 29 is an attempt to affirm that we are taking marriage seriously. Although you may be able to find exceptions, the general rule still stands. The most secure environment for a child is an environment that will meet his emotional and intellectual and spiritual needs, and that is in a home where its mother and father are married and living together. I hesitate to bring it up because it's so emotionally volatile, but the fact of the matter is, in the aftermath of the Davidian branch massacre, we've almost forgotten something that's very important. Our shock and our horror at what happened to the members of that society has distracted us from a crucial fact. And my sympathy for those innocent lives that were immolated in that inferno cannot
ignore the fact that this was a microcosm of a sick society. And those who left it before the end, escaped before the Holocaust, have given testimony to the fact that the family was redefined, that marriage was redefined, and the people who have escaped have given testimony to the fact that their personal lives were traumatized as a result. I have another concern, and it's partly selfish, but I think it is something that needs to be addressed as well. I understand that currently nearly 75% of the marriages that are done in this state are performed by clergy. And if at some time in the future the definition of marriage were to be changed, it is possible that many of the clergy could be found in jeopardy because of their consciences. We as individuals or as a class could find ourselves facing litigation on the basis of discrimination because we could not in good conscience perform a marriage ceremony where it was not a case of one man and one woman. That has happened already in the area of employment with regard to churches. And although the courts have upheld the position of the church to date, the cost to individual churches has been great, and there is no assurance that another assault will not be launched. In my opinion, HGR...
Excuse me, sir.
Representative Walker?
Mr. Chair, I'm very confused about your last statement. Would you run that by me again? How were the churches discriminated against here?
I say that there have been court cases already in which churches, because of their beliefs regarding certain hiring practices, having to do with homosexual hiring, have been brought before the courts, and that is a matter of record, and at great expense have had to defend themselves as being claimed to be discriminatory because they refused to hire somebody who is homosexual.
Who's different? Homosexual?
Homosexual.
Any other reason the church would want to not hire somebody?
This is on a religious basis.
Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reverend?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Reverend, I was interested in your comments about how difficult it is for some churches to deal with this issue of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But are you aware that there are many Christian ministries that do perform a blessing or a sanctioning, a community sanctioning of gay marriage?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay. I have another question for you. When you frame your response, would you also please address your feelings about that or your perspectives about that? Because I think that would be useful to know. But my main question to you, Reverend, is societal engineering or policymaking notwithstanding, what is it about the granting of health benefits to people who have paid for them? You know, what is it about granting partnership health benefits to a partner of somebody who's paid for those benefits the same as I have paid for my husband's benefits or you have paid for your wife's benefits? What is it about that that is offensive to you?
I don't think that that's germane.
Actually, that is the gist of the Tanner decision.
I'm not talking about the Tanner decision.
And it is germane.
HJR 29. HJR 29 is an attempt to define marriage within certain boundaries.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
May I answer?
Actually, are we under a call? Okay. I think that's an opportune moment to recess the hearing for the call.